Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Politicology. I'm Ron Steslow. This is our weekly roundup, where we bring in a rotating panel of experts to discuss the truth you need to know behind the most important stories of the week and how they're shaping the political landscape. On today's panel, returning to the roundup, is the brilliant Lucy Caldwell. Lucy is a veteran political strategist, tech founder, and former senior political advisor at the Goldwater Institute. Lucy, it's great to see you, as always.
Good to see you.
Also returning to Politicology and making his roundup debut is George Conway. George is a conservative attorney, my fellow Lincoln Project co-founder, whose pontifications, quips, and corgis can be frequently found in a number of outlets, most often on Twitter. George, how you doing?
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back. On this week's roundup, the political fallout from the botched Afghanistan withdrawal, we'll talk about how Republicans are reacting and how public opinion has shifted in the last month. The nation's highest court let a historic bill restricting abortion access in Texas go into effect this week before weighing in Wednesday night with a 5-4 decision to let the law stand while legal battles continue. How so-called new Puritanism is upending liberal democracy. And we'll find out what stories the panel is watching. And finally, in our segment for Politicology Plus subscribers, we'll talk about the January 6th committee's latest records request and Republicans' threats against private companies that comply. Let's dig in. On our August 20th weekly roundup, we addressed the question of blame regarding our messy and chaotic and violent withdrawal from Afghanistan. And this week, we released a 2-part conversation with national security experts Molly McHugh and Mark Polymeropoulos, where we took a deeper dive into how and why it all went wrong, a look back at the complexities of why we were there to begin with and what we achieved and what happens next. So with those substantive conversations in the background, it now feels appropriate to talk about the raw politics of this catastrophic last month for the Biden White House. So we've heard a few Republicans using words like impeachment and resignation, and it's easy to see how this entire episode produced a lot of fodder for Republican attacks against the president. But we've also seen an important shift in public opinion that could change how much political capital the White House has to spend in order to achieve its top priorities, whether or not this has any bearing on voter attitudes in next year's midterms. So the Real Clear Politics average in early August had Biden's approval at roughly 51%, with 43.5% disapproving of the job he's doing as president. And given the level of negative partisanship, an 8-point positive approval rating is pretty good. Fast forward to the end of August, in the same average, and Biden's now underwater by 2 points, 47 approve, 49 disapprove, and 538 agrees, with his approval at the lowest point in a post-war president's first term, aside from Bill Clinton, Gerald Ford, Donald Trump. So Lucy, I was thinking about this, and as people who are practiced at applied politics, I tend to think of top-line national approval ratings as sort of tactically useless, generally, because, they make for a lot of hot air on cable news, but they don't indicate whether, power is likely to shift as a result of elections until you drill down further. So, for example, according to Reuters, Reuters Ipsos polling data from August 26th, Biden is plus 31 with urban voters, dead even or around plus 1 with suburban voters, 21 points underwater with rural voters. And each of these figures has moved away from him in the last month. And you and I have talked a lot about the urban-rural split, and there's lots of threads to pull on there. But help us read between the lines a little bit. How do you read the shift in public opinion vis-a-vis handling of Afghanistan withdrawal? How useful is that measure, if at all? And how concerned should Democrats be about it?
Well, August is just the toughest month of the year across the board. And I think that although Biden saw a little bit of a dip in August, I think that some of the indicators, when you look at the crosstabs of his overall approval rating and how Americans feel about individual issues, I don't think he's in as bad of shape as one might think. In that poll you mentioned, he still has Americans' confidence when it comes to the economy. He still has their confidence when it comes to things like handling coronavirus. Mm-hmm. And those are the kinds of issues that are likely to determine future elections. One of the things that I think is kind of hasn't been discussed enough about the Afghanistan withdrawal numbers is that in that same poll, we see that although there is general disapproval of the withdrawal from Afghanistan, there is approval for aspects of the withdrawal. For instance, resettlement of Afghans in the U.S. who helped Americans in the war on terror in this crazy multi-decade era. And that is the kind of individual issue when you think about sort of projecting out months and months and months. Those are the kinds of issues and realities that do become determinative in local communities. Yeah. You know, how do people feel about having, you know, an influx of Afghans, and it turns out they feel pretty good about it.
Yeah.
And so when you think about as the kind of wounds of and the distance grows from the actual withdrawal, which is so fresh right now, a lot of the ways that those things are going to be showing up are things like, how does it make people feel in their local communities? And we have every indication to suggest that they feel okay about it. I think any president was going to take a bit of a dive just in the Afghanistan withdrawal, because for all the reasons that none of them ever did it, because we were in an unwinnable war in a very tenuous situation.
Yeah, I think that's right. George, as a result of all this, Kevin McCarthy is now under increasing pressure from the vocal right side of his caucus to call for Biden to be impeached because of the claim that this is, you know, evidence of his unfitness for office. That's what they're saying. Now, obviously, nothing of that sort would happen unless Republicans take back the House in November. But Politico notes that a lot of this pressure at its origin is grassroots from Republican voters who are angry and haven't stopped being angry since they were told the election was stolen and now want to see Biden removed from office. And so we've seen McCarthy in this situation before, and he tends to bend. So, you know, after the House impeached Trump twice in 2 years, do you read this as inevitable that Republicans are going to try to do the same thing against Biden to settle political scores? Or how do you read the overall reaction from the right?
I think the overall reaction of the right is, if it wasn't going to be this, it would be something else. And I think the answer is going to be Senator McConnell, who says, ain't nobody going to get impeached.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, ain't nobody going to get removed from office. And he thinks, quite rightly, it's a waste of time. And, you know, I think the point that Lucy makes is absolutely right, which is any president would have taken a big hit.
Yep.
Because this was a government that was destined to collapse, whether it did so in a matter of days or a matter of months. It clearly did not have the wherewithal to survive. And anytime you have, you know, basically a collapse of a government, and you have groups of people who are fearful that the new revolutionaries are going to come in and do bad things to them, you're going to have a panic. That's what we saw in 1975 in Vietnam, and, you know, with less video available because people weren't carrying around smartphones, but there was still some remarkable video of helicopters lifting off from an apartment building that was used by American diplomats in Saigon, and of, you know, U.S. sailors on aircraft carriers pushing helicopters off flight decks to get more helicopters in to land. I mean, crazy stuff. But, you know, you're always going to have something like this. And that's why Trump never did it. And I am not going to be critical of Donald Trump. I have not been critical. I wasn't critical of Donald Trump when he signed the Doha Agreement, even though there are aspects of it I think maybe I didn't like. But he had it essentially right, which is, you know, he wanted to get out because he didn't see the point to it. He didn't think it was doing us any good, and he was fundamentally right. Now, he didn't have the courage of his convictions. He wanted to push it.
Do it.
He wanted to push it past the election. And again, I mean, I'm not a fan of Pompeo, but they did something very smart. They essentially cut a deal with the Taliban, say, you stay in place and we'll be out of your hair next year. Okay, as long as you just, you know, don't attack us, don't, you know, keep it at a low boil, and after the election, we'll be gone by May. And essentially, they kept to that deal. The best time, frankly, to get out would have been last winter. Mm-hmm. Right? The time to get out would have been, I'm sure you probably discussed this with your military type experts or your foreign policy experts, would be to get out just as it's starting to get cold, which allows you some lead time because the Taliban couldn't come down from the mountain in the winter, mountains in the winter. And at least there you wouldn't have had an immediate collapse. But here you were going to, you know, there was no good way to do this. Now, you should, perhaps I think the government should have foreseen how quickly this government, the government in Afghanistan would collapse. I think they tried, I'm sure there were many elements in the government at State Department and the Defense Department that convinced themselves that the Afghanistan government could hold on for longer than it could because, you know, you've invested so much into it. But, you know, apart from that significant mistake, the significant error, you were always going to have some level of chaos. And I think one of the – sometimes, you know, there's a lot of times when public opinion, even if it's not fully well-informed, which it usually isn't, mm-hmm. where the instincts of the people are actually pretty good. And here on the left and right, people understood this war wasn't doing us any good and we had to get out of it at some point. And that's the reason why I think at the end of the day – Biden won't be hurt by it, I think, because what he did was broadly recognized as the right thing to do by the American people. They didn't want to be here, and they didn't want to pay for it. And at the end of the day, he showed a lot of strength in just saying, okay, I'm not going to let all these attacks, I'm not going to let all of this keep me from doing what I said I'm going to do and what has been American policy for a couple of years now.
Yeah. So your point about there's always going to be chaos in some fashion reminds me of an op-ed that Steve Israel just wrote in The Hill describing a conversation he had, I think it was all the way back in 2008 when he was in Afghanistan talking to a member of armed forces there who was sort of shepherding a congressional delegation around. And he asked, should we even be here given that basically the person described a whack-a-mole situation where, that is battling the Taliban and says like, they've been doing this for 200 years and they're going to be doing this for-
And right, they're not leaving.
And they're not leaving.
They
right,
live
exactly.
there.
Yeah. And their resolve is sort of far stronger than, right. than
and
ours.
Because and so, they know we're not going to stay here forever.
Right. Right. So the other point you raised about public opinion, I wonder what both of your thoughts are on this, because it's come up a few times, especially when I'm talking to national security experts, and in particular, Molly McHugh raises this repeatedly, and it is the preference on both ends of the political spectrum now to be disengaged for an America that is disengaged from the world stage. And she calls this, she refers to this as sort of a pincer of isolationism, where on the right, we have developed this sentiment that it is not our job to intervene in other places, like it's not our responsibility. And in fact, that sometimes takes a more xenophobic tone, like right. the Taliban aren't, Afghanistan's aren't ready. They're too primitive for American style, democracy, right? And then on the far left, you have, not even the far left, but on the left, I think you have this growing sentiment of it's not our right to intervene. We have no right, we have no moral authority to impose American interests or values in other parts of the world. And so those two forces together for completely different reasons create this wave of public opinion that basically creates pressure for America to withdraw from the world stage. And I wonder what you think about, George, your point about, while ill-informed, oftentimes public opinion is, it also has the tendency of being right in aggregate. It's almost like the social psychology phenomenon where, if you take a group of people who are looking at a jar of jelly beans and trying to, any individual one person will not guess the accurate number. But if you take an aggregation, an average of those guesses, it's usually very close to the actual number of jelly beans in the jar. I lay that at your feet, and if it makes any sense, do you think that this emerging trend of public opinion for a more withdrawn America from the world stage is right?
Yeah, I don't know that the public opinion supports some kind of withdrawal from the world stage. I think it requires – my guess is, and I haven't studied the polling data, is that they want a more restrained view, but they don't – no one's calling for withdrawing American troops from Western Europe or Japan or Korea. Or,
I think most people don't know that we're there,
honestly. Right, we're there, and nobody seems to have ever – have a big problem with it. The only person who had a problem with some of it was Trump. Mm. And I think that, you know, and nobody's saying, oh, we should just basically take the mothball the Navy and let the Chinese have the Pacific. Yeah. Nobody is saying that.
Yeah.
And nobody on either side of the political spectrum, and there's no clamor for it in public opinion. So I don't think – I mean, I think it's wrong to suggest that withdrawing from Afghanistan and the sentiment – in favor of withdrawing from Afghanistan presages isolationism. It didn't happen in 1975, although people were saying, oh, this is what's going to happen after the – after I remember people saying that after the fall of Vietnam. It didn't happen. And I think we have to defend our interests, and I think Americans believe that we have to defend our interests around the world, or we still have them. And I think – I mean, the point that Biden is trying to make is a good one, that we do have interest and we have to focus on the big issues, which is basically a global competition with the Chinese and to a lesser extent Russians.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that one of the things that this has laid bare is how much neoconservatism has gone out of style. And, you know, it's often hard to understand, just even if you just look at the right, at what forces were at play that sort of took someone like Liz Cheney sort of out of public favor among the Republican base, and why did this happen? And we've speculated a lot about what forces are at play. But it's often, I think I often tend to look at what's happening among the Republican brass as, well, this is mostly not about policy, but this has been a moment that really shows it kind of is in some circumstances. I think that you see someone like Adam Kinzinger spending a lot of time really kind of pushing, like, we've got to stay the course, we've got to get back in there. And the response to that is crickets.
Yeah.
And no one wants that.
Yeah.
I mean, the foreign policy blob, which I remember hearing that phrase a few years ago. I've become very fond of it now. I mean, the blob is part of what led to Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Okay. The feeling that these people are out of touch, and, you know, Trump being saying we are a country run by stupid people. Mm. What are we doing in Afghanistan? That had a lot of appeal to people.
It did.
The fear, I think, is that we fall back into what I kind of think are sort of some of our worst national impulses. And even when you look at the poll numbers and of American support for Afghanistan withdrawal from the beginning of August to the end of August, you really see a shift of people souring on it, you know, especially I think after the loss of life of those 13 members of our military. And you see how quick we are as a country to get back, to get our hairs up.
Yeah.
You know, even Joe Biden in his address after that loss of life talked about how we have to get vengeance. Mm-hmm. Why? Why is that something that is so fundamental to us culturally? Mm-hmm. Why do we have to go get vengeance, you know, to this, what is an awful episode? But those kinds of episodes make me think, is there a bit of writing on the wall for just inevitably falling back into this pattern of, you know, 6 months from now, 18 months from now, being back there? And if it's not Afghanistan, maybe it's somewhere else.
The notion, though, of striking back isn't what got us into trouble here.
That's true.
What they did in Afghanistan, what the CIA fundamentally did in Afghanistan in the fall, winter of 2001, 2002 was quite remarkable. There basically was no serious ground deployment of American soldiers, maybe a few advisors, but mostly it consisted of CIA operatives helping to coordinate groups of tribes in the north, as I understand it, the north of Afghanistan who were upset with the Taliban.
Yeah.
And they basically toppled the government by leveraging off indigenous descent in Afghanistan. And it was a remarkable achievement. And that, you know, allowed for the projection of force against Al-Qaeda. The problem was, you know, the terrain is such that you can't really root people out of their caves very easily. And if we had stuck to, okay, we punished the Taliban for providing a home for Al-Qaeda and focused on trying to find bin Laden, which we were doing, but and didn't get into the whole idea that we need to create a Western-style democracy in Afghanistan instead of letting the tribes work it out for themselves, as they have been doing for centuries, in essence, we would have accomplished our goal, which was to basically to strike back and not be – not allow
and squash the terror
this
threat.
Attack to go without a significant response. And the irony is we did that and we never really dealt with the – with part of the issue, which was Pakistan, right? I mean, Al-Qaeda could not – have been hiding out in those mountains without the help and the Taliban were basically supported by the ISI.
The most nominally of U.S. allies.
Who we pay, who we fund to the tune of –
I put that in like so many air quotes.
Hundreds of millions of dollars, a year or a decade. I don't know what the numbers are. And where was Osama bin Laden hiding out? He turned out he was hiding out in Abbottabad, Pakistan, a few hundred yards away from the Pakistan Military Academy. That's where he ultimately was, not in Afghanistan. So, you know, the whole enterprise of trying to create, you know, a safe space in Afghanistan was not really a coherent, tailored response to what happened on September 11, 2001. And it became, of course, enormously expensive in terms of blood and treasure. And the irony was, you know, we struck back to overturning the tide. I mean, nobody was going to – could have doubted American resolve after we basically blew the Taliban out in 2001 and 2002. And at the same time, the biggest thing I think we did to protect ourselves from another 9/11 was – something had nothing to do with defense. It was, you know, reinforcing the cockpit doors. And there are so many different things we can do to protect ourselves from terrorist attacks on our own soil that don't involve, you know, expensive foreign forays. That said, we need to, you know, be able to figure out where the bad guys are coming from and covertly at least do something about them. But we – I don't know that we helped ourselves by getting bogged down in trying to build a nation that we didn't know how to build.
Let's leave it there. This past Wednesday, the Supreme Court denied a request to stop a new Texas law that bans abortions at 6 weeks from going into effect in a 5-4 decision. This is the first 6-week abortion ban that has been allowed to go into effect. Under the new law in the state of Texas, abortion is prohibited when a fetal heartbeat is detected, which is often before a woman knows she is pregnant. There is an exemption in the case of medical emergencies, but no exception for rape or incest. This law is unique in that it emboldens private citizens to enforce it by way of suing abortion providers or anyone who assists a woman in terminating her pregnancy after 6 weeks, with a potential payoff of a $10,000 bounty plus attorney's fees, which notably are not recoverable for anyone sued under this statute, even if they win. And as if on cue, I noticed this morning there's already an anonymous tip line website put up by anti-abortion activists asking people for leads for people that they can sue. So, George, with so much to get to here, I'm just going to turn it over to you to talk through the legal mechanics. First of all, the reasoning behind the enforcement structure in the Texas law. What do people need to understand about what's happening outside of all of the very loud noise that is happening, probably for good reason? There is significant panic happening now all across the internet, all, you know, everywhere you look. And so, what do people need to understand about what's actually happening here? What happened in the Supreme Court decision? Why is this law different procedurally? And what really matters?
Well, I mean, it's an insane law procedurally. Clever in a very devious way.
Okay.
At the same time, you know, people who are saying that this law represents the death of Roe, I think they're wrong and they're misguided.
Okay.
And to explain this kind of takes some explaining. I don't know that it will make people happy. It's one of the reasons why I don't like talking about abortion, because the people who are pro-choice think you're pro-life, and the people who are pro-life think you're pro-choice.
Yeah.
And any nuance kind of gets thrown to the wind. And I tried to explain this to this morning to someone, and she basically said, "This sounds like you're These are instructions to putting together a vacuum cleaner.
But well, I think it's important. I think it's important to understand.
Okay, so what they did here, the way that most abortion restrictions that turn out to be illegal under whatever iteration of Roe and Casey exists at a given moment, which has changed over time, is usually someone brings, like usually an abortion provider brings a federal lawsuit against a state enforcement authority, like a district attorney or an attorney general who is charged with enforcing the state's abortion laws. And the claim is, you court should give me an injunction against this guy who is charged with enforcing this law, which contravenes the Supreme Court's decision in X decision, in X case.
This
public official.
Okay.
And what happens is, if you convince the court, whether the district court or the court of appeals or the Supreme Court, that in fact this is contrary to Supreme Court precedent and contrary to the undue burden standard of Casey against Planned Parenthood in the 1992 case, you get an injunction that says this state official cannot enforce that law. So what they did here to get around that ability to get enjoined,
they being the Texas legislature.
The Texas legislature is they said, okay, we're not going – this law, which purports to ban abortion after, 6 weeks it was, is not enforceable by state officials. It's enforceable by – people,
anybody,
and we'll give you. Basically, it's a bounty system. Yeah. It's kind of like the QI-TAM system that's used.
They're crowdsourcing.
It's kind of like what's used to
really.
I mean, there are federal statutes that say if the government is wasting money somehow, you can sue and recover part of that as a private citizen. And the problem with that is now, when the law went into effect the other day, it's not clear who you sue. All right. If to get an injunction, it's just federal courts 101. Okay. Yeah. Every federal law student learns this, is required to learn this. Under Article 3 of the Constitution, you have to have a live case or controversy between a plaintiff and a defendant, where the defendant is doing something or threatening to do something that would harm the plaintiff, and the plaintiff has a right to stop it,
right,
or right to get damages against it.
Right.
And in order to get an injunction, it's the same thing. You have to order. You can only get an injunction if somebody is about to do something that harms you, and you can identify that somebody, and you can identify the something that they shouldn't be doing that harms you. The problem here is, who is that person? We don't know who they are because they haven't sued yet. They haven't identified themselves yet. And so you don't get an injunction immediately. And that's why everybody's like, oh my gosh, this law just went into effect. Well, the counter argument is, well, it kind of went into effect, but we don't know how it's going to be enforced or whether it's going to be enforced. And under sort of fundamental principles of what courts have jurisdiction to do, it's not clear that you can enjoin anybody for it. So that's the problem they created, and that's what happened last night with the Supreme Court's decision. It says, yeah, this has real problems under our abortion jurisprudence, but it's not clear they can get relief at this stage. Now, that doesn't mean – and here's where people are making one of their mistakes.
Okay.
It doesn't mean that the law, the constitutional rule doesn't get enforced. It just means it gets enforced later in some different way. When somebody actually brings one of these private suits, then you can go and sue them and say they don't have the right to do that. And maybe this group that just set up an anonymous tip site could be sued and enjoined from bringing these lawsuits on the theory that they're the people you can sue, and then you'd have a concrete case and then you'd get an injunction against them. Or if somebody actually brings a lawsuit, you could get an injunction against them, and then you could create some precedent that says this is unconstitutional.
Right.
That's sort of the technical aspect of why the Supreme Court did what it did last night, and I don't fault it for doing what it did last night. And it made clear, and people are omitting to mention this in a lot of the discussion today, they said, we are not passing judgment. We are not saying that this law isn't unconstitutional.
Okay.
We are not dealing with the merits here. We're just dealing with the technical aspects of whether or not you can get an injunction in this case at this time. Now, the broader point I think that's worth making about this case and this law is that the other hot take is this is just they just overruled Roe.
Right.
They just overruled. And that's just, again, they didn't say they were doing that and they didn't do that. And the truth be told, this case isn't the case that matters.
Okay.
And I know that that's people are going to say, oh my God, but it's restricting abortions has the effect of restricting abortions in Texas. And that's true. But the reason why it has that effect is because of the other case that's got up before the Supreme Court that's going up for plenary argument, the Mississippi case.
Okay. So
here's the reason why. Again, this is the vacuum explaining the vacuum cleaner instructions.
No, this is actually really useful for me. Yeah.
If there were no chance of Roe being overruled, then this whole Texas, crazy Texas statutory scheme, this Rube Goldberg enforcement mechanism would not have any effect, any practical effect. Because if you're an abortion provider and you know the Supreme Court's not going to overrule Roe, you can take the risk of getting sued by these people because you can invoke Roe as a defense under current precedent. And you can say, I shouldn't have to pay $10,000. I'm not going to – this is illegal. And you would win your case and pretty soon people would stop bringing these lawsuits. Okay? The problem is the reason why you would fear liability today if you were an abortion provider in Texas is because, well, what if the Supreme Court next year – overrules Roe. If it does do that, if it did a full-blown overruling of Roe that permitted abortions to be prohibited after 6 weeks, well, then you're potentially liable. And that's the reason why this law has the effect. So the point I'm making is if Roe were not overruled, this law would have no effect. If Roe is overruled, that's where the problem is and you'd be doing something that's illegal anyway. So under the law. And the problem is if you're – I think the case that is dangerous to Roe is the Mississippi case, not this one.
Not this one. Okay.
Okay. And what the Texas legislature did, and I think it's part of the devious nature of what it did, was it was taking advantage of that legal uncertainty. All right.
Okay.
That's sort of my take on
okay.
that. I mean, I got a lot of takes on this,
no.
And it
this
doesn't
is,
make people happy.
No, but it's important. You're explaining something in the type of detail that never gets treatment.
Right. It doesn't that's sort of the problem.
It is part of the problem.
With the discussion about abortion in this country is that it gets oversimplified and over
– Bumper-stickerized.
On – every side, every which way. And it's sort of impossible to express a thoughtful view without somebody saying, you are for killing babies or you are for coat hangers. And it's sort of a problem we have that's particularly prevalent in this fraught area, but it's
so
extending to other aspects of our political life.
Just one follow up to the effect of this law going into effect. You said it kind of goes into effect because we don't know exactly who would be who you could seek injunctive relief against, right?
No, it's not correct.
Right.
I mean, it kind of goes into effect because you have this law that says,
but
this is illegal.
So is it true to say then that the rights protected in Roe are nullified by this law in Texas in practice, at least right now?
I think that it's not that they are nullified at this moment. The problem is, I think if you were an abortion provider, what you would say, and I think they're right, is that you are chilled from exercising your constitutional right to provide abortions to women you have that right that's derivative of a woman's right to choose an abortion. And that's what the effect of this law is and was intended
right now,
to be.
Like today, as we're taping.
Correct. I mean,
it's
right. Because if I do what I normally do on every day of the week, or I did last week, I run the risk of being sued by 50 people and held liable and basically put out of business.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
So, that's a legitimate.
So in reality, like you can't get an abortion in Texas right now because of this chilling effect.
Correct. Right. Or that's what they're saying. I mean, maybe they're, I don't know.
And there are doctors who are affiliated with, say, Planned Parenthood clinics in Texas who have said they feel that they must follow new guidelines based on this law.
Right,
right. So
they don't want to be, the law says that. And
so in effect right now, regardless of how, while they may not have explicitly overturned Roe, they have explicitly allowed a law to go into effect that prevents in practice right now, while this Mississippi law is pending anyway, prevents a woman from being able to terminate a pregnancy after 6 weeks. Like that is what's happening as a result of this law in practice. Okay. So I want to talk about the dissents for a minute because they're different, right? So Chief Justice Roberts writes about this in his dissent about the procedural uniqueness, right? He said the courts need to consider whether states are able to avoid responsibility for their own laws. Can states essentially crowdsource law enforcement to citizens? And in her dissent, Justice Sotomayor wrote that the Texas law was written to evade judicial scrutiny precisely because of the enforcement mechanism. What are the dangers we'll face if we see other laws that crowdsource enforcement? Do you think that part of the, especially when constitutionality is going to be challenged on crowdsourcing enforcement in that way?
Well, again, problem is unique to this circumstance, okay? Somebody was saying online, well, you wouldn't like it, Mr. Conservative, if they did this with guns.
Right. This is the question.
This is the question.
Could this possibly be a blueprint for unconstitutional laws?
Well, you couldn't do it with guns.
Until they work through the court.
Well, you couldn't do it with – if this is an attempt, obviously, and Sotomayor is right, to avoid an injunction against a state prohibition that's unconstitutional. She's right there. And Roberts is right. I think the question is – would that have any chance of having that effect in some other context where the law were similarly decided and not subject or likely to be overruled? Because in that other circumstance, let's say you could sue all gun owners for owning a gun.
Yeah.
Okay. The answer would be you wouldn't be able to collect damages there because the Second Amendment under Heller and the Chicago case gives you the right to own a gun. So the difference is that Roe might be overruled. Okay, that's the reason why – that's the point I'm making earlier.
I see.
That's the reason why this crazy nutball – enforcement mechanism attempts to avoid injunctions actually can have an effect is because of the uncertainty that has cropped up regarding Roe.
Got it. Okay. So I imagine a lot of our listeners are not feeling very comfortable about this, about the takeaway so far. So Lucy, abortion is frequently a top issue for single issue voters. How would a pared back Roe affect turnout on either side, do you think? And could this be an electoral boon for Democrats? In general, how are you thinking about this development?
Thanks for saying that. Because, George mentions that this is one of our sort of many ongoing national discussions that has no nuance. And so I know that emotions run high when talking about this issue. So, what I'm suggesting here are really just political realities of the situation, which is that this is a massive boon for Democrats. And I would say that in general, we often conflate how people identify whether they're pro-life or pro-choice with how they feel about a woman's right to an abortion and how they feel about Roe. So I revisited this week Gallup keeps data. They basically ask the same question. They've done it for decades, right? And I looked at Americans' opinions on abortion in the last 30 years. And whether or not a majority of Americans report being pro-life or pro-choice, this may not be what people want to hear, but that changes all the time. Mm. I mean, it's still shifting. You have times where people are, I mean, in the last 10 years, you've had this where people report mostly being pro-life, then they mostly report being pro-choice. I think that context, like what's going on in state legislatures, what's going on with fetal heartbeat bills has a big impact. But something that has not changed is Americans' support for Roe v. Wade. And I was really interested this week in revisiting how Americans feel to see that support for overturning Roe v. Wade in the last 30 years, the last three decades, has never topped 36%. Roe v. Wade is overwhelmingly popular with Americans. And so what does that tell me? Well, what should it tell us? I think one of the things it might tell us is that people are much more likely to be motivated to go out and vote in a certain way because they want to protect a woman's right to choose than they are the opposite. I mean, so when you think about, okay, who are people who want to see Roe overturned? Mm. And it's kind of hard to get good crosstabs on this. Crosstabs being like, who are these people who say this thing? Yeah. But I would imagine that that group is pretty locked in, right? Like conservative Christians, evangelicals, that their opinion about abortion is pretty part and parcel with whom they vote for.
Yeah.
Whereas then you think about other audiences of people, other blocks of voters, like suburban women who might find themselves in a lot of elections voting for a pro-life Republican.
Right.
You know, that's not my phrase, it's just our useful shorthand, but making a different choice because it is an issue that can be really motivating as a single issue for folks. And so when you then also look at a state like Texas that is going through a big demographic shift, this is a massive boon for Texas Democrats. And I think that you'll see that in a lot of places. And another thing that I think is really important to think about, and, you know, I'm not the lawyer here, George is, but, and I know I bring this up a lot and no one loves it as much as I do, but if we just revisit our sense of federalism, if Roe v. Wade were overturned, which I know for a lot of people is a nightmare scenario, that does not mean that women in Massachusetts are not still able to get abortions. I'm not commenting right now at all on the challenges or logistics of women in, you know, the economic challenges, taking off work, being able to travel. I'm not taking away from that at all. What I mean to say is if you then see that piece of federalism in action, and again, projecting out the scenario in which, you know, the sky falls, Roe is overturned, you are then going to see a massive, massive mobilization of pro-choice groups working to ensure abortion rights in every state. And it's going to become this massive motivating factor. And so while I know that this is kind of like a pet issue of a certain sector of the right, I think that one of the worst things politically that could happen for Republicans and for social conservatives would be to have Roe v. Wade overturned, because they're then on defense. And I think that the kind of the massive wave of support for access to safe, easily accessible abortions would be unbelievable. So not commenting on individual women's individual experiences, but I think this is a massive boon for Democrats any way you slice it.
So you bring up a really interesting point, which I think we may have talked about before, but I think it is true that on the right, abortion tends to generate a lot of heat, a lot of intensity, but very little effect in terms of turnout.
Right.
And so basically what you're arguing is that that it will have the opposite effect on the Democratic side because of essentially loss aversion.
Yeah.
And you're saying that in that it's in states that actually are in play or becoming more in play.
Right.
Okay. I wanted to do something a little bit different for our final roundup segment this week. And instead of a news story, I wanted to center a discussion on a piece that Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Ann Applebaum, who we are all very familiar with, wrote in The Atlantic for their October issue, because it ties together so many of the threads that we pull on in this show regarding accountability and justice and redemption and the lack of a mechanism for redemption in the internet era. titled The New Puritans and writes, "Right here in America, right now, it is possible to meet people who have lost everything, jobs, money, friends, colleagues, after violating no laws and sometimes no workplace rules either. Instead, they have broken or are accused of having broken social codes having to do with race, sex, personal behavior, or even acceptable humor, which may not have existed 5 years ago or maybe 5 months ago. Some have made egregious errors of judgment. Some have done nothing at all. It is not always easy to tell. Nuance and ambiguity are essential to the rule of law. We have courts, juries, judges, and witnesses precisely so that the state can learn whether a crime has been committed before it administers punishment. We have a presumption of innocence for the accused. We have a right to self-defense. We have a statute of limitations. By contrast, modern online public sphere, a place of rapid conclusions, rigid ideological prisms, and arguments of 280 characters, favors neither nuance nor ambiguity. Yet the values of that online sphere have come to dominate many American cultural institutions, universities, newspapers, foundations, museums. Heeding public demands for rapid retribution, they sometimes impose the equivalent of lifetime scarlet letters on people who have not been accused of anything remotely resembling a crime. Instead of courts, they use secretive bureaucracies. Instead of hearing evidence and witnesses, they make judgments behind closed doors." Now, Anne uses a number of vignettes to illustrate that although in the U.S. there is no state coercion generally against speech, fear of the internet mob, the office mob, or the peer group mob is effectively stifling intellectual free exchange of ideas. And worse, decisions affecting the livelihoods of individuals are made without due process and without mercy. There is no criminal charge or jury, and there is no examination of evidence. But people who've had their lives, who've had their lives turned upside down by, you know, quote unquote, the mob, frequently professors and journalists, often can't continue to function in their professional or even their personal lives. So, George, you first. A lot of Anne's piece actually focuses on what happens after the mob goes after someone. You know, the decisions made by administrators or boards that become terrified of, you know, when they become the target of anger and hysterics, what Anne calls the illiberal bureaucracy. How do we empower individuals, ourselves, to defend from, you know, the mob and from knee-jerk responses by decision makers? And just more broadly, how are you thinking about this emerging illiberalism?
Well, I think she's right. I don't think it emerged just in the last few years. I think it's been emerging for decades. And I think the only answer is more nuance, okay? Mm-hmm. More nuance, yeah. And more thoughtfulness.
If only.
And I don't know whether that's really possible in the current political and media environment that we have. But, you know, not all stupid statements or politically incorrect statements are created equal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? There's a difference between, people who just make a mistake or say something infelicitously, and somebody who's saying something with real, racist motivation. Mm-hmm. There's just a huge spectrum of things that some things I would think that you should be shit canned for, if I may use that word on this podcast. And there are some things where you should be able to say, oh, look, I didn't mean it that way. Or on reflection, okay, that's not right. But the problem is, people panic. Yeah. People in charge of these illiberal boards or institutions panic because it's not worth it to them to be the next person in line to be attacked. And I just think that I just think that it requires more people to say, okay, I don't agree with what this person said. I think that what this person said was reprehensible, but it's not a firing offense.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think we need to have more people saying that and willing to say that without themselves feeling that they are fearing that they themselves are going to be next on the list.
Right.
And so I don't know how you get there.
Yeah.
Because with this cultural phenomenon, but it's part of why we have this political culture that's developed on the right, where people say things precisely to offend the powers
that
be.
That's exactly right.
You know, where it becomes where you have this kind of performative idiocy. And that, again, it makes it – again, that's doing nothing but making the political and cultural environment in the country even more toxic.
Right. I agree. I don't think it is possible to have – more nuance. I just don't – the trend is not going that direction.
No.
You're not going to stop the tide from rising. And so if that's true, if that's the case, then how
we're
do
doomed.
You – then are we actually doomed, or is there some kind of – you know, are there some kind of protections that you could put in place? Maybe it's workplace, you know, reform. You know, maybe it's some kind of reform of workplace laws. I don't know. But
I don't know that you can, because it's like – because you have – there are First Amendment protections to firing somebody who says something stupid, right? You have the right to – you know, you have the right to not have me on my podcast if I say something that you don't like. not have you on – me on your podcast.
Yes. Do you have a podcast?
No,
can
I
come
podcast.
On it?
Okay, too many podcasts. We don't need any other podcasts.
This is it. All we need is Politicology. Right. I'm very, very nervous about the idea that what we need to do to sort of figure out how to reform mob justice is, you know, to think about codifying new laws.
Yeah.
And in fact,
although I sympathize with that.
I really appreciate a couple of things that Anne Applebaum does in the piece. One was she very rightly highlights, she doesn't use the word cancel culture.
Correct.
She's very clear about that. And she rightly really exposes the fact that even though it's become this right-wing boogeyman, the stories of the people that she's highlighting are mostly not even on the right. And I think that's really, really important, because it actually reflects that the people that this hurts are often moderates or people at the
liberals.
Liberals.
They're liberals,
or
actually.
Liberals.
Yes.
Yeah, no,
But in terms of whom it silences, right? I mean, when you look at last summer, there was a little bit of fallout. Well, I guess a year ago, there was fallout about during the sort of height of the post George Floyd stuff and Black Lives Matter movement in that summer. There was a lot of fallout for a ton of sort of reality show celebrities, right, who were like people on Bravo shows, right, who suddenly got thrown off their podcast feeds, punished, including by platforms like Apple Podcasts, right?
Yeah.
There was a woman named Stassi Schroeder, who was a Bravo celebrity, right, who basically had been found to have made some kind of in poor taste comments, and nothing that was really that appalling. And she lost all of her sponsorships, which, of course, the sponsors have the right to do that.
Sure.
She was fired from the Bravo show, and she also was taken off of, I think, Spotify and Apple. And I remember thinking at the time, well, that's fine for her sponsors. And of course, these are all private actors, but some of these same companies are sponsoring podcasts or publishing the feeds of people like Dan Bongino or Rush Limbaugh. So, but it's just that in a way, those people on the right have found a way to insulate themselves because they're in this lane. And so the kind of lack of ability, and this is really up to the audiences, but to apply these rules, whatever they are, evenly, is a problem. Another thing, though, that I've really thought about, in addition to whom this hurts when reading this piece, you know, I think that, and you set this up a little bit in the piece of the article that you read, which is this idea that we really believe in due process and the rule of law. I kind of reject that frame a little bit. And the reason is that as a person who would like to have a kind of optimally small government and keep Well, let me rephrase that. As a person who would like to see government stay out of individuals' lives, I'm very much in favor of a society in which there are all kinds of penalties for improper actions and conduct that don't have anything to do with laws, right? I don't want to have a new law for every problem, right? I don't think that new laws are generally the best solution. So a culture in which there are repercussions that are extrajudicial, to me, that's optimal. But then the question becomes, well, then you're kind of back at this question of like, well, what are the consequences, right, and who determines that? And it does go back to when, you know, Anne talks about how a person who was really harmed by this talked about three pools of people. An academic who'd been kind of forced out, talked about, you know, you suddenly have like the heroes, your colleagues who are standing, yeah, by you, the people who are out to get you, and then the much larger group of people who just
nice
say
but useless,
nothing.
Right.
Nice but useless.
Yeah.
And that's the most concerning group, because that's where we really, really are out of step. Because the reality is, most Americans, if you ask them individually, they would say, I think the punishment didn't fit the crime, or, yeah, or, you know, but there's no incentive to,
yeah,
be out there.
She says in the piece that the stated goal, or like the, you know, maybe not the stated goal, but the goal tends to be to punish and purify. And it's this purification of what we think and what we're allowed to say that I think is kind of alarming for liberalism generally. That's the part of it that like rubs me the wrong way, that makes me, you know, fearful of where this heads.
Yeah. And I think that the point Lucy made, yeah, is that the people who are most affected by this,
yeah,
are in liberal institutions, are
right,
then are, and they themselves are liberals.
Right.
Newsrooms.
Yeah.
Academic,
yeah,
academia. Those are the people who, when you talk to them and you get them, you know, when they're not, no one else is listening, they'll tell you how terrible it is.
Yeah.
And of course, they would never go out and say that publicly the way Anne Applebaum did, because that would subject them to attack by,
right,
the mob.
Right.
You know, the people who are saying, look, that's just, you're showing your white privilege,
yeah,
or what, something, some kind of attack like that. That if you say, well, you know, this person shouldn't have been fired for that, or I have to worry about everything I say and do, even if I don't, I have to worry about,
yeah,
being called a racist for,
yeah,
doing things that just, for just saying something that should be just ordinary, at least, or that should be just said, oh, if you disagree, here's the five reasons I disagree.
Yeah.
And then the other point that Lucy makes is just absolutely right. It's like, the government can't regulate this stuff.
No, yeah, right.
Because
yeah,
it's free speech.
Yeah.
It's right. Free speech within an institution. It's,
yeah,
it's, you know, institutions have the freedom to destroy themselves.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And to basically decide that they don't want to associate with someone who said, you know, use the wrong word,
yeah,
at the wrong time.
And the bigger challenge in some of this, I think, when what Anne calls mob justice, when it goes too far, the other audience of people, the other sector of people it really, really hurts are the sometimes truly aggrieved parties, right? People who are being sexually harassed, or people who've been the subject of something unfair, who are the victims. Because if we, you know, we have to find the equilibrium, because we also
Some of this stuff trivializes real problems.
Yeah,
right. And we have to be able to say, to figure out, it's not even, and I think in a lot of these cases, whether or not someone should face some kind of punishment, but
yeah,
whether the punishment is life destroying,
right,
when that is probably a little,
yeah,
too much. You know, fundamentally, whether the punishment fits the crime.
Right. Well, and I think she gets at that. And that's I think this is why she sets up this idea that, I mean, she highlights the idea that in a liberal pluralistic society, we have due process. We have enshrined the idea of due process and the examination of evidence, and that none of that happens. So there is no way to tell whether or not the punishment fits the crime, because there has been no assessment of whether or not what is the crime precisely, and how do we gauge what the punishment ought to be. And how do we even assess whether or not there was a crime to begin with? And so, but I think there's an important electoral piece of this to discuss, because this is, I think, by plenty of accounts, especially plenty of accounts on the left, a particularly problematic phenomenon for Democrats. And James Carville even said this in April. I read this interview he gave to Vox, and he goes, we can't say Republicans are going to call us socialists no matter what, so let's just run out and out as socialists. That's not the smartest thing to do. And maybe, you know, he's talking about, you know, the abolish the police maybe tweeting that we should abolish the police isn't the smartest thing to do because almost fucking no one wants to do that. And he goes, here's the deal. No matter how you look at the map, the only way Democrats can hold power is to build on their coalition. And that will have to include more rural white voters from across the country. Democrats are never going to win a majority of these voters. That's the reality. But the difference between getting beat 80 to 20 and 72 to 28 is all the difference in the world. And so, and earlier in the interview, he says, quote, wokeness is a problem and we all know it. And he's talking about we Democrats. And so like, so I'm wondering if the political incentives for I don't know, an immunological response by the Democrats among Democrats to try and contain this phenomenon might actually be the most sort of motivating, I don't know, some way of moving past the moment where we are now. Is that a crazy way to think about this?
You know, I think there's a separation, and I'll defer to Lucy on this since she's the professional political
hack
consultant. I think there's a distinction between the public discussion and understanding of these issues and then the understanding of these issues among readers of The Atlantic,
sure,
and people who work
absolutely
at major universities,
George,
as professors.
Everyone I know reads The Atlantic. I mean,
what I mean is like the extent to which this phenomenon has been weaponized by the right against the left. As,
I don't
you know,
think people in, I don't know, Shanksville, Pennsylvania,
yeah,
I don't know, central Pennsylvania,
yeah,
wherever,
are not talking about this in this way.
Are not concerned about the political environment in the New York Times newsroom,
right,
or at a Yale faculty meeting.
Right.
Although, you know, those things do affect – they do kind of spread out to the
sure
broader society.
Because they change the way culture is created.
Yeah, they're – you know, they're – people out there are concerned about the – you know, about what people are saying about Dr. Seuss being banned.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? There's just a
mm-hmm –
there's a connection but a disconnection,
yeah,
between the problems that Anne is describing, which are rich people's problems,
mm-hmm,
and then, you know, the ordinary Joe in the diner, Joe and Mary in the diner, yeah, who have Fox News on in the corner.
Yeah.
It's just a different
– you're,
you know,
so right about,
you know,
that.
Yes. I mean, you could call them both cancel culture, but – it's a totally – it's a different thing.
Yeah.
It's a different thing that has some similarities, but I don't think controlling what Anne is describing would have a political impact because it's just removed,
yeah,
from the political life of ordinary Americans.
Okay. Now that we're up to speed on three of the biggest stories of this week, let's talk about what we're watching. Lucy, do you want to start us off?
Sure. So – I have been really interested in what's going on at the local level amidst redistricting, amidst, you know, sort of the lead up to next, mm-hmm, cycle. And there were couple of things that came on my radar this week that I think all kind of fit in. One is that ProPublica published a big piece about what is, from a mechanics standpoint, happening at the local level in terms of people joining precinct committees, party apparatus, sort of,
yeah,
join up, recruitment, and also people taking an interest in way, way, way down ticket races. And from the people that brought you Donald Trump, Steve Bannon has really, really worked hard to build huge, huge constituencies of people who are becoming local precinct committeemen, really, really sort of cementing the, let's call it Trumpian, I know we don't love that phrase,
yeah,
but the Trumpian hold on the party. And this has been consistent. But I think it's an interesting thing to think about as we think about how lines are going to be redrawn. So I would encourage people to think about that. One of the things that I hear a lot from, and I talk a lot to so-called never Trump people, but also from the left, is a big focus on federal races next year.
Mm.
And that's, I understand why people are thinking about that, but I've been thinking a lot about how there are so many governor's races up,
yep,
so many secretaries of state's races up.
And local boards of elections, like
exactly.
All.
Exactly. Yeah. And there are so many Republican governors in office right now who I think would not be able to be elected today because they are not sufficiently proto-fascists, let's say. And so we're going to see a lot of those people being termed out of office, plus the combination of new lines being drawn for the non-statewide offices. And the ProPublica piece just really highlighted that this is a thing that Republicans are working very, very hard at. And I think that Democrats could sort of find themselves once again not with the eye on the prize. Mm. Something that relates to this is something else that was written this week by Will Wilkinson about basically the Southification of rural America.
Yeah.
And it's a good way to think about these things. And it reminds me a lot of stuff Mike Madrid has said about how we're missing the axes, essentially.
Yes.
But thinking about that helped me to think about this other idea of what does the Republican machinery look like going into 2022. It was essentially this idea that rural America across the country is taking, to your point about urban versus rural, is taking on a kind of Southern culture in a place like, say, rural Maine.
Yep.
And I think that we really need to just be looking at these things happening at the state and local level, because I think it's really easy to overlook a lot of that. And to me, that dovetailed with that line of thinking.
100%. 100%. George, what are you watching?
What am I watching?
I don't know. Handmaid's Tale? I don't know. What stories are you watching?
Oh, what stories am I watching? Okay.
Or one story.
I guess the story, maybe I'm just hooked onto last year's news or early this year's news, is the January 6th insurrection investigation.
We're about to do that in the Plus segment.
And, I didn't mean to preempt it, but I think, one of the things I find interesting about what we do and don't know about January 6th is there've been these books that have come out, and there were news stories at the time about how people were trying to tell the former guy, mm-hmm. you know, you got to go out there on TV. You got to say something. You got to do this. You got to do that. This is a problem. It's bad. And they, you know, everybody and their mother was saying they tried to get through, mm-hmm. and they had multiple phone calls, or they admit to having multiple phone calls. They're willing to say what most of them are willing to say what they said, what they were urging, but they never say what the response was. Why did they have to keep calling? Okay, there are a few hints of that in some of the reporting immediately after January 6th, where the Washington Post said the guy was an absolute monster that day. But one of the things we haven't been hearing, including in these remarkable books that have come out, mm-hmm. including the mm-hmm. Carol Lenig and Phil Rucker book, is what was the response, and why aren't they telling? So the question is, why aren't we hearing what that response is? And that's what I think all this part of this cover up is all about. Why McCarthy doesn't want to produce.
That's a great observation.
Doesn't want to produce, and the Republicans don't want to produce phone records. Mm-hmm. They don't want to talk about what they knew about what was going on down the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue and what they were told by others, because there must have been a lot of gossip and hearsay about what, you know, did you get through? Did you get through? So, you know, I just think that there's mm-hmm. just so much there that we don't know about. And that's going to come out. And I think that's why it's motivating some of the backlash among the Republicans.
We are going to go to the after party in a minute and talk a little bit more about that precisely. But before we do, where can everybody find you on the internet, Lucy?
Well, they can find me on Twitter at Lucy M. Caldwell.
And George.
Same. Well, not at Lucy Caldwell, but at G.T. Conway, G.T. Conway III. And, you know, I do write columns from time to time for the Washington Post.
Thank you to everyone at home and on the go for listening. There are a number of ways you can help support this work and our mission. You can donate, which helps support the huge team and effort that goes into every Politicology episode. Or you can join the growing, thriving community of Politicology Plus members and gain access to hours of special content designed to help you think more like a political strategist, to look further down the road than everybody else, and understand the forces and figures shaping the fight for democracy. If you're not already in our Politicology Plus community, you can unlock today's Plus segment and much more at politicology.com/plus. You can share this episode or one of your favorites with friends, family, or colleagues. Podcasts tend to grow based on word of mouth, and this helps us reach more people. And you can rate 5 stars in the Apple Podcasts app and leave us a review there, because this helps us rise in the rankings so that new people can discover Politicology organically. If you have questions about anything we've talked about, you can reach us, as always, at podcast@politicology.com. And even if we can't respond, we do read everything you send us, whether it's an episode idea, a guest recommendation, or a simple note about how the show has impacted you. And we love hearing from you. I'm Ron Steslow. I'll see you in the next episode.